Hello, everybody. Happy New Year. Welcome to the first episode in 2023 of Scholarly Peers. My name is Sin Wong Chong. I'm your host of this episode. And to kick us off 2023, I'm very, very happy and honored to have Professor Jonathan Tomlins from Durham University, who will talk to us about his experience as an editor, peer reviewer, and of course, an author himself. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello, and thanks very much for having me.
Jonathan, would you like to tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So, hello, everyone. I'm Jonathan, and I've worked at Durham for about 10 years. And before that, I worked at Teesside, and before that, at some further education colleges and adult education and things like that. I did my PhD on a part-time basis, starting in 2005 and finishing in 2011, which allowed me the opportunity to publish during the period of study in a way that a full-time student might not always have because I had more actual time available to me. And since then, I've carried on publishing in a range of different journals as a single author and as a co-author. I've done a lot of peer reviewing, as I know many of us have, and I've also done quite a lot of editing of one kind or another, either special issues or on a more permanent basis for a number of different publications. From both Wiley and Taylor and Francis.
Right. So I notice, if I get it correctly, you are one of the editors of the Journal Review of Education. Mm. And is it still the case?
No, it's not actually. It's not. No, I was until fairly recently. I mean, the whole editorial team of Review of Education has now actually changed because, as you'll know, Beera asked for new editorial teams to be refreshed every few years. So I actually stepped down from that journal some months before my term would have been up because I had lots of other work to do. I'm the incoming deputy editor for Ethnography and Education, which is much more closely aligned to my own research and intellectual interests. And so stepping back from the Review of Education was not, in fact, a difficult step for me to take.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting because the journals, the two journals, I mean, Review of Education and the Ethnography one that you're going to take on, they have a very heavy emphasis on methodology. So Review of Education focuses on evidence synthesis, and the Ethnography one, I assume it's ethnographic research. So I may come back to that later to ask you for your experience in editing, journals that have a very specific methodological focus later on. So let's start by sharing with us some of your unforgettable peer review experiences, and I will leave it up to you to interpret the word unforgettable. And let's start with your author's experience.
Sure. So, like many of us, I very much enjoy seeing the reviewer two stories that come up on my Twitter feed on a fairly regular basis. So this is a nice story because this is an occasion where reviewer two was actually amazing. And it was the other reviewers who caused the problem. So a while ago, I'd submitted a paper. Am I allowed to say the name of the journals here? I am, aren't I? I submitted a paper to Studies in Higher Education. So one of my areas of work is in higher education research, and it's an excellent journal to be in. I've been in it a couple of times, and I've been rejected by it a couple of times, so I'm fairly sanguine. And I sent my submission in, and after quite a time, it came back with three reviews. So what's happened is that reviewer one didn't really like what I was doing, but provided a really good and detailed exploration of where their critique rested in terms of the work that I put forward. And so even though I could imagine that reviewer one had said either reject or probably major revisions, it was a really good example of a review process at work, a real serious challenge to some of the things I was putting forward and asking some really insightful questions about what I was writing. Reviewer two said, I kid you not, this should be published as it is, and really, really liked the paper, which obviously I was delighted by because that's the kind of response you always want. And so the editor of the journal had then sent it out to a third reviewer to be the casting vote. And the third reviewer sent back a review that was about 17 words long and, not written particularly well and was entirely useless as a review. But this became the 2-1 vote, and so my paper was rejected. So I emailed the editor of the journal and said, you know, what's going on? To be told, well, we have so many submissions and blah, 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 blah. And that was it, radio silence. And then after that, the editorial team there changed and the conversation got lost. And so I did what I have done once or twice before, which is have a bit of a sulk. And then I sent the paper somewhere else. So I then sent the paper to Higher Education Research and Development, which again is a good journal in the field of HE studies, where I'm happy to say that it was accepted with very minor revisions and came online within a few months.
Right. Okay.
But certainly the experience with studies on that occasion illustrated that, you know, a split decision is one thing, but, you know, because I'm an editor as well as a reviewer, I always think, well, yes, very often I will send out to a third reviewer to get a casting vote. But, you know, you want that third review to be of decent quality. You know, as an editor, if I'd received that review for a paper that I'd sent out for someone to read, I would have rescinded the review and asked someone else to write it, even if it meant postponing the decision. So yeah, it was a learning experience for me as an editor, as well as, you know, a good example of the kind of review that none of us really hope to receive.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, one of the themes that I keep hearing from my interviews with different guests is the role of editors. Editors aren't supposed to just click buttons, like I receive this, I forward this, you know, I invite reviewers, you know, editors need to make a judgment about the quality of the review, the relevance of the review, and, you know, if it's necessary to step in and to say, no, this is not, or, you know, to give his or her opinion. So I think your experience speaks to so many of our experiences as well.
I think that's right. And I think that it's something that I try to do as an editor in different capacities. So I'm now an associate editor for Higher Education Research and Development. I've edited other bits and pieces as well in various capacities, and edited and done guest editing for special issues. And one of the things I've always tried to do is say, well, one of the things you're asked to do when you log on to Manuscript Central is this review sufficient, right? And it has to be the case that a 17-word review is not sufficient in any way, shape or form. And, you know, I get that there's a lot of papers coming in that editors have a lot to do, but, you know, on the other hand, no one's making you be an editor. And for the larger journals, such as Studies in Higher Education, I could imagine that the stipend is probably, you know, quite worth having in order to compensate you for some of your time. So, yes, you'd hope that maybe I just caught the editor on a bad day and they had too much to do, because we all have, you know, these pressures at different times of the academic year. But, yes, you know, I think I'm as an editor, I'm very happy to make editorial decisions. I've got one. In fact, I've got one on the go at the moment where, for a paper that I was editing for Higher Education Research and Development, came back from the original two reviews with one saying minor revisions and another saying major revisions. I thought the major revisions were a little harsh, and my comments to the main editor were, let's go more with reviewer one rather than reviewer two, because I think reviewer two has rather missed something here, and I think what's going on is this, this, and this. And I put that in my comments, which also went to the author. The author sent back the work and had done what I thought was a good job. The original reviewer one wasn't available. I did send the paper to reviewer two, who actually recommended reject, which I again thought was, I think they've really missed something in terms of what's going on. And I thought, well, it's now becoming unfair to the author to keep going again and to find new reviewers for a revised submission, I think, is a very difficult thing to do, because it's very hard, I think, for a reviewer to be told, well, this has already been looked at, so we just need you to check the corrections. I think that's quite a difficult thing. So I thought to myself, well, my sense of this is that we should publish this, but of course it's not my call. So I went up a line to the main editors to say, this is what I think is happening. And happily, the main editor agreed, yes. You know, she also thought that the author had done very well, had responded to the comments that were made, that the reviewer that was available had rather gone off at a tangent. And so that piece will go into production. So that's a nice outcome for the author. Mm-hmm. And again, there an example perhaps of where as an editor, you need to be able to say, well, I get what you're doing, but I think this review is going a bit off-piste. Let's say yes to this piece of work. We think it's worth publishing.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, sometimes editors really need to step up and, you know, to take on what you're supposed to do in your role. I guess we're already in that question about unforgettable experience as editor. I wonder if you have another narrative to share, or, you know, of course, what you shared just now is your experiences, but I wonder if you have another narrative you have in mind.
As an editor or as a reviewer?
As an editor, yeah.
As an editor, let's think. Well, I've got several as an editor. I mean, there was a good one from a few years ago where I'd sent a paper out for review and both reviews came back pretty critical, one of them very much so. But I it would have been very easy on the basis of those reviews to reject the paper in question. But I just thought to myself, do you know, I think this is a really interesting idea, even though it's been not executed as robustly as you'd want it to be before it goes into press. So I took the key comments from the two reviews, and then from one of the reviews, I took out a couple of the comments that were made before passing them back to the author. I then added in quite a lot of my own additional comments as the associate editor. And then when I sent it up the pipe to the editor-in-chief, said, well, this is what we've got. The reviews have been pretty fierce, but I think there's something interesting going on here. This is what I think is happening. I think, you know, we could argue that we have a sort of academic and professional obligation to encourage this author to take this away and come back with something. And even though, in fact, it was quite a protracted process because we did have to have a second set of revisions later on down the line, that paper did eventually, you know, turn out to be really rather good and did get published in the journal in question. So it took a long time. And perhaps for, you know, the author, of course, never knows what goes on behind the scenes in this way. So for the author, it may well just be the case that they look at this paper and think, blimey, that took me two loads of major revisions before it got accepted and took about a year. What a pain in the neck that was for me. I'm not publishing with them again. But in fact, the paper was very close to being rejected. But we actually thought, you know, I thought there's something here worth chasing, even if it's going to take some time. And happily, you know, the author bought into that rather than withdrawing the paper, did the work, did the second round of revisions later on, and eventually the piece got published.
Right. So it's good to know, you know, even as, you know, as operating in a big journal, you do have that autonomy, you know, to express, you know, your opinions toward a piece and to, you know, to have a say in the decision. It's quite interesting. You mentioned your experience working as editors for different journals. I wonder when, because for outsiders, you know, an editor does certain things, associate editor does certain things. But from my experience, I've been, you know, I'm associate editor of two different journals and the roles are vastly different. For example, you know, for one journal, associate editor does not make editorial decision. Whereas in another journal that I work in, I actually make the editorial decision as like one of the editors. I wonder, how do you navigate those roles and what's your experience with those journals?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. So it's it is different for different journals. And I think there it's something to do with, you know, the working relationship that you establish with the next layer up, as it were. So, you know, if you're an AE working for a group of, you know, of one or for two or for four editors in chief or co-editors, it's something about how they set up the relationship between you as one of a bunch of associate editors and their overall control. So, you know, are you, you know, the decisions that you make aren't decisions that will be concrete. You know, they could turn it over, but, you know, I flatter myself that the decisions I've made as an AE when working for HERD have always been the ones that have been accepted by the co-editors. And they've always welcomed dialogue, you know, outside that formal, you know, manuscriptcentral.com driven process when I've wanted to fly a decision past them where I can say, well, I think this is what's happening here. Can you tell me something about whether you think I'm on the right lines or have I missed something? And so, you know, co-editors have always found to be very, very, you know, constructive partners in that conversation. So it is a dialogue rather than just those editors in chief saying, no, we want it to look like this. And I think that's, in the case of HERD, then it's, you know, it's to a credit to the overall editors of the journal that they're willing to engage in that. When I was an editor on Review of Education, which is much more narrow remit, there were about five or six of us at different times, although with one and then later two sort of main editors who oversaw everything. It wasn't the most interesting work for me personally, because it's not a style of work that I write and that I research, but it was useful editing experience for me to come across styles of work that normally I wouldn't come across in my academic life. So in that sense, it was quite a useful exercise. But there were, as I say, there were lots of editors, and the number of papers I had to look after was never so great. The real problem on that journal was getting people to peer review, because the papers were all quite long. So, you know, if you're sending out a paper that's a systematic review that's 14,000 words, it's pretty difficult to get someone to read it compared to something that's only six or seven. So that was an exercise much more in patience and emailing back and forth to get people to read things, different kind, a much more sort of almost bureaucratic process rather than an intellectual or editing one.
Right. What I learned from listening to you is, you know, regardless of your role, I mean, how you participate fully in the review process. You know, some people may say, I'm just an AE, you know, I don't make the ultimate decision. I just look at the reviews and just recommend based on the reviewer's decision, you know. But what you, I think you did much more than that, and you participate in that dialogue. I mean, with the editors and the authors as well, right?
Yeah, I do. I think that's because I like it. Because I think it's, you know, it might. You know, I don't know whether it's, you know, I don't know exactly what it is, but the processes of writing are interesting to me anyway, and I enjoy writing. And on a good day, when you get good comments from a useful editor, that's a really helpful thing. I know, you know, editors are more or less light touch at different publishing companies, and you know, you'll read some things that appear on the shelves that you think, well, an editor's barely had a look at this, and really it could do with some blue pencil. Whereas other things, at other times, I really value that. But yeah, overall, I think it's an inherently engaging process. If I think it's in a field that you're also working in, because it gives you the opportunity to, well, it makes you read more widely, doesn't it? There's so much stuff published, we don't have time to read as much as we need to. And we all do more writing than we should, and do more and don't do enough reading, I think, you know. And we can have those conversations about the way in which REF drives us all to that level of distraction. But doing reviewing work, and again, reviewing for a range of journals, as well as doing editing work, I think, you know, gets you out there and makes you see what people are thinking about, what's coming up, you know, where are the interesting conversations taking place, what are other people reading. And I think that keeps you fresh. I like it.
Right. I wonder if you have any experience as a peer reviewer then.
I mean, one of the things that, so I did some collaborative work over a period of years, all predominantly online and well before COVID lockdowns, with Professor Anna McLeod at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia and her team. And this sort of sideways move, because of my particular methodological interests, looped me into medical education, which as a field is amazing, because it operates almost entirely outside, you know, what we'd call education studies from a UK university context. Like a whole parallel infrastructure of conferences and literature and papers and scholars and so on and so forth, even though so many of the ideas and themes are very similar. And so as a consequence of that, I increasingly got asked, once my name got attached to papers that were appearing in medical education journals, I was then asked in turn to review for medical education journals. And the way they go about their business is very different to the way in which education studies journals go about their business. And as a consequence, I've then come across work as a reviewer that I would never have come across otherwise. You know, like, you know, a group of clinicians writing a paper based on community of practice theory, or a group of medical instructors writing a paper based on actor network theory, or whatever it happens to be. And, or, you know, another group of clinicians using rapid ethnography to frame a clinical study. And these have been tremendous, A, because it taps you into a body of work that is simultaneously familiar to you, but also entirely novel. And that I found extremely interesting to do. But the other interesting thing about it is the structure and formatting of the reviews for some of those medical education journals, which are, you can see a much more sort of heavy emphasis on the evaluation of the pieces that are coming in, you know, sort of implicit moves towards scoring, or in some places explicit, you know, requests for scoring. How good do you think this is on this scale? Which was a little new to me and not something I particularly enjoy. But the opportunity to read that work was absolutely, was entirely interesting and, you know, important to my overall academic development and interest over the last few years.
Yeah, I think that's extremely interesting. We talk about your review experience for other disciplines. I wonder, when you construct your reviewer's report, for example, say for an itchy journal or for a medical education journal, I wonder if there are things that you do differently, for example, in terms of your positionality, or of course the journal requirements is one thing, what you're asked to do. But apart from that, in your own flexibility, would you be doing things differently?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? So on the one hand, we all know that it always takes a long time to find people to peer review. And it's harder for me than ever as an editor to find people to review things. But on the other hand, you think, well, if there's lots more people writing, you'd hope they'd all be willing to review stuff as well. You know, if every time you wrote something, you reviewed two things on a kind of moral contract, we'd never run out, would we? We'd be fine. And yet it doesn't happen. So we know that there are lots of people who are saying no. I try and say yes to a whole bunch of stuff, although I don't say yes to as many as I used to because I've got loads of things to do. But what I can also, what I am also able to do now is, you know, you'll say yes to stuff that you know is going to be particularly interesting to you because of its empirical context or the theoretical framework that it's resting on. And so that allows you to sort of specialize a bit, if you like, in terms of the choice of material that review. So in terms of the things I get sent from journals for which I'm a member of an editorial board, I tend to be a little bit more fussy than I used to. So mm-hmm. With that said, once I've got the work in front of me, if the journal asks for some kind of score, I'll do it. But otherwise, I'll try and treat them all exactly the same way, which is I like to I'll go through it and I'll read it I'll read the paper, I'll note it up. I will print it off because I'm very old school. I'll write all over it, and then I'll provide an overall statement of what I think is going on, and then the specific notes. You know, well, on page 2 you say this, what's going on here? On page 5 you've got this, whereas on page 4 you had that. So what's going on there? So you try and create that dialogical exchange between that fine-grained reading, as well as just providing that overall holistic snapshot of the overall rigor of the work as you see it.
Right. Okay. I'd like to change our focus now to look at your own history or your becoming from a novice researcher to obviously a senior and experienced academic in terms of peer review. I wonder, can you take us back to your day one or your first manuscript submission experience? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Share with us how you navigated it.
Yeah. Yes, I can. So this was fairly early in my time as a part-time PhD student. So I'd started my PhD in the early part of 2005, and then the following year, in the summer of 2006, I gave a paper. So I did my PhD at Lancaster, where I was supervised by the entirely brilliant Mary Hamilton. And the following summer, Lancaster hosted Higher Education Close Up. So this is a conference for fine-grained higher education research that moves from Lancaster to South Africa and back again every 2 years, although, of course, it had been interrupted recently. And I gave a paper at that. And then they said somewhere, there was an advert that said, if you want your paper from the conference to be considered for a special issue of a journal, please submit your paper at the end. And I thought to myself, well, I've got nothing to lose, really. You know, you've got to start somewhere. So I didn't check in with my supervisor, which even though that's the advice I give to my own students, I just blithely went ahead and did it anyway. The paper was accepted. fairly quickly, only after a few months. And I thought, well, this is tremendous. You know, that's my first paper. You know, I'm on my way to becoming an academic. But then for various reasons to do with the editing of the special issue overall and production and all the rest of it, it took 2 years before the paper finally appeared in print, by which time I'd sort of, you know, got, you know, sort of thought to myself, well, if this is what's going to happen every time, this sounds like an absolute disaster. Although I was soon reconciled to the length of the process. But my first encounter with being published was in a special issue. And this was for the International Journal of Education Research that was then published in 2008. And it's a paper I'm still perfectly, I'd have done many things differently. I'd have given it a different title. I would have given it different subheads. The abstract is a disaster zone looking back at it. But the actual body of the paper, I'm still quite proud of, actually. I think it's all right. And provided a chunk of a chapter for my eventual thesis later on.
I want to dwell into that mental process of yours when you say you just went for it. You know, yeah, they had an announcement about that. I mean, but did you think about, you know, what made you that motivated and determined to do that?
Well, I guess it was I knew about academic conferences in the abstract. You know, but I'd attended, you know, various kinds of development things in the past, but this is the first time I'd been to one as a PhD researcher, and you're out there putting your work together. But you know, I'd spent time on the paper, I delivered the paper and it went well, and I had a couple of people who were members of the academic staff at Lancaster who I'd not met before came up to me and said that they thought it was very good and they'd enjoyed it and thank you. And I guess maybe it was just those comments where they said, oh, well, they liked it. Brilliant. Maybe it's okay. So, and I thought, well, I've written it anyway, because I'd written a full paper to take with me. You know, if you remember those days when people would turn up with, 5,000 words rather than just some slides. So it was a pretty easy step to just say, sure, read this paper and see what happens. And I think if I'd overthought it, I probably wouldn't have done it. But maybe it was just a sort of rush of adrenaline at being at a conference that made me put it in without thinking too much about what might happen next. It's a long time ago. I can't really remember so well.
No, but I mean, it's what most PhD students that I encountered would ask: when am I ready to submit my manuscript? I mean, they presented, they got feedback, but when am I ready?
That's a trick, isn't it? You see, because I was doing mine part time, I had the actual calendar time to allow peer review and then publication to turn, right? Because it takes a long time. So, by the time I'd finished my PhD, I'd published three or four papers in different journals. So of course, when you hand in your thesis and say, well, chunks of chapter 3 were published here, chunks of chapter 4 were published there, chunks of chapter 5 were published here, it's going to be pretty difficult for the examiners to beat you up too badly, because you've already had your work scrutinized. For the full-time student, it's pretty hard. You've got 3 years and maybe you're writing up here. We know it takes months to get reviewed. We know it takes months to get into production. It takes 12 months sometimes for a paper to be accepted to finally appear in a print issue with a chapter and volume number. And the push and the increased competition to get a job at the end of it means that, for a new appointment, for someone coming to a job at Durham, we'd ask for, two peer-reviewed papers. And getting two papers out after a full-time PhD is a pretty difficult ask, actually. So it's harder to do, but yet somehow the pressure is there. And then attached to that pressure is the fact that so many conferences now don't ask for working papers. And if you turn up to, you turn up to BIRA with a set of slides and some notes, well, that's fine. But if in the old days you turn up at BIRA with a working paper, well, then you've got 6,000 words under your belt ready to get commented on the day, right? So you take your comments from the people in the room and you chat to your friends and to your supervisor if they're there, and you've got a working document. If you turn up to a conference with a set of slides and some notes, well, you've still got to turn it into a 6,000 or 7,000 word paper. I think that the move away from the working paper at a conference, I think in some ways, makes things more difficult, certainly for PhD students. So One of the things that we still have at the Ethnography and Education Conference, if I can give it a plug, is that we do ask for working papers from everyone. But what that does then mean is that for everyone, whether it's established staff or for newer researchers or for students, you get that same level of feedback on your working paper, and it's quicker to turn it from a conference paper into something you can submit.
Right. I wonder if you have phased any challenges in the peer review process. You mentioned one of them, for example, it takes time to you know, go through the whole process of peer review. But I wonder if you have other challenges that are quite vivid to you.
I mean, the main one, well, there's two, aren't there? There's two. The main one is time, as you say. The other one, as an author, is when you've had reviews come back to you, going back to that conversation we had earlier when some editing is more light touch than others, where the reviews, you know, sometimes provide more or less interesting accounts of what they think you've been up to, but sometimes can be quite vague on the specifics of what they're after. So on the one hand, you're thinking, well, yes, I know this bit. Right, you think this bit needs some work. So what you want to do is respond to the questions that they've raised, but there's the tension between maintaining the integrity of the work that you want to put forward and the pressure to do some, you know, what we, you know, some prints pleasing. So yeah, I used to be a medieval historian, and there's many years ago, and there's a genre of literature which is called prints pleasing literature, where some poet would write some piece of work and then give it to the king, and the king would say, well, this is an excellent poem because it says how great I am, have this bag of gold coins as a reward. And it's a bit like that. Yes, you want to please your reviewers, but we shouldn't want to please them too much. And that's something that's taken a long time for me to acquire. And it's a difficult thing to say, I think, to newer researchers or to PhD students. But I think something that we should be more open about is, well, reviews are there to be responded to, but we should also be willing to challenge them as well. And when we see something that's like, no, you're asking me to move too far away from what I'm interested in. If you want that, then you write your own paper. You know, and right. I've seen those kinds of reviews written as an editor, and I've received those kinds of reviews as an author. And as an editor, you can soften that in your comments and the way you treat the paper afterwards. As an author, you then have to be careful about, you know, picking your battles, don't you? Well, this I'm going to push back on, that I don't mind so much, I can do something with. But this thing I'm not happy about. And a good editor, and hopefully a good reviewer, will respond in spirit and say, no, fair point. You know, we'll let that, you know, you're right. You know, you're right to push back. We can do it. In just the same way that at your PhD viva, you know, there's times when you should be saying to your examiners, yes, you've raised a good point. And there's other times when you should be pushing back at your examiner saying, well, no, because what I'm doing is whatever it happens to be. So that again, that more, you know, the review process more as an exchange between critical friends rather than you need to fix it like this before you can come through the gate, I think is a mindset that perhaps for some of our academic colleagues needs refreshing.
Right. Thank you. I have to ask you a question because as a qualitative researcher,
yeah.
I mean, we all know we face challenges when yeah. we receive reviews, especially from reviewers who are not familiar with qualitative research methodologies. So yeah. we see that on Twitter a lot about reviewers asking for sample size, effect size, yeah. You know, validity and reliability. I mean, how do we go about responding to comments like those as a new researcher?
You know, I mean, this is the trick, right? So what I have seen as an editor in the past is when, for example, and I've seen this as a reviewer as well, is when an author might, for example, have taken some data that's really qualitative, interpretivist data, and quantified it in order to do something with it, but in a way that's completely bogus, right? They say, well, no, you shouldn't be doing that. You know, treat it as what it is. I've never had a review where I've been told, right, your sample size is too small, or, well, this is no good because, you know, your definition of reliability doesn't add up or whatever. And when I see all these comments on Twitter, and what I want to know is, where are people sending their work, right? Because there are a lot of journals, and a lot of them I wouldn't really worry about wanting to be in, but there's still a lot that I'd be perfectly happy to have my work published in. Is it the case that people just don't pay attention to aims and scope? That can't be the case. Is it the case that they feel pressure to publish and rush stuff in? I don't know. Is it the case that editors are bad at choosing reviewers because they're short of reviewers or just not sufficiently attentive. It could be any or all of those things. I genuinely don't know, but that is a mystery to me, actually, because
right.
you know, if you've written something that's an interpretivist case study, there will be a proper home for it in a journal that produces a lot of that kind of work. So, you know, don't think that you need to send it to a general purpose journal that covers everything when you know you'll find a very good home for it somewhere else.
So do you think one of the reasons, maybe because for your work, for example, it's quite specialized in terms of methodology, and there are journals specializing in those methodologies. For example, you have an ethnography journal, of course, yep. if you submit your ethnographic study there, people will understand what's happening.
Exactly.
And just like a systematic review, if you submit to a review of education, people know what a systematic review is. But I mean, for a lot of people, when they use like more general qualitative research methods, and they submit to generalist journals, and it's, you know, when reviewers review the manuscript, you know, they may come from a quantitative background.
Yeah, they don't get it. That's right.
I think that would be a reason. Yeah.
I think it might be the part of that. Yeah. Yes, I do. I think that might be what's going on. I don't know, because you'd have to do some research, but that would be a hunch, yes.
So the last part of our interview, I'd like to ask you some questions about how you support early career researchers and doctoral students in the peer review process. And you have worked in different universities, you know, study as a student. I wonder what you think, for example, universities can do better, or maybe supervisors can do better, or other parties that can do more to support ECRs.
That's right. I think you've got two things. In terms of responding to reviews, as a supervisor, you want to try and be there as a critical friend throughout the process, don't you? So, you know, be willing to read the work before it goes in. And this doesn't have to be for a supervisor. This can be for, you know, an ECR. You know, it doesn't even have to be a formal mentoring thing. It can be hopefully just something that you know you're happy to help with. On that, you know, well, the collegiality is getting hard to come by in our increasingly busy times, isn't it? And it's hard to find the time to do this. But, you know, if you can find the time to read something for someone before it gets submitted, especially if it's an area of work that you've had a lot of experience in, I think that's a really nice thing and an important thing to be able to do, to provide, if you like, an extra pass, you know, with that editorial perspective and or reviewer perspective on the work in question. So you can hopefully help people prepare for the review process, or, you know, help with any snagging before the manuscript goes in, and also help with how they're going to respond to the reviews that they get back, especially if it's something, if that whole sort of area of response to reviewing is a new landscape for them. In terms of helping people write, if you sort of talking about PhD students and you're trying to get PhD students to publish, you know, an area of controversy which is varied across academic disciplines, and this is something you'll have seen as well, Xinwan, is the way in which you'll see a supervisor's name appear as a co-author on a paper in some cases and not in others. So in some academic disciplines, it seems to me that this is entirely an automatic process that your supervisor goes on as a co-author, even if they didn't actually write any of that actual paper. I think that's wrong, actually, and I refuse to accept that that's a good thing to do. I think that supervising is one thing, but I think if a student's written a paper, their name goes on it, and unless you've actually done some writing on that paper, your name shouldn't appear anywhere. And so one of the things that I like about the medical education journals, going back to them from earlier, is this: they were early adopters of this model where you have to say at the end of the paper which author contributed what. So this author did some analysis, this author did the literature review, these two authors conducted the fieldwork, whatever it happens to be. So helping students write stuff is a good thing to do as a supervisor, and encouraging students or early career colleagues through the review process is a good thing to do when you've got time. And again, it's just about that, you know, that environment in which you're situated as an academic, that you sort of turn around to yourself and you almost without realizing, you think, oh, okay, you know, I'm classed as a senior academic now, right? I'm since the start of this academic year, I've been a professor and I've published a moderate amount of work and I've done a lot of reviewing. So you want to try and find ways to help share that with people if you can, because you know it's a difficult world, but it's an essential one that we have to be part of. So, yeah, it's just something about trying to make yourself available where you can, and at the same time, obviously, not overstretch yourself, and also hopefully where it's aligned to your own interests in terms of your departmental colleagues more broadly. In terms of your PhD students, I think encouraging people to write is a good thing to do, but there's only so many hours in the day, and the most important thing is the thesis. So if you think that the thesis is going to suffer because you're saying, what do you need to publish, or that your student's mental health is going to suffer because you keep saying, but you need to publish as well as do your thesis, then I think as supervisors we should back off and try not to get stuck in that arms race. And then hopefully, you know, once the dust has settled a little bit, as the study comes to a close and as writing becomes the main thing that the students engage with, well, then we can start to read the draft chapters and we can say to the student, you know, if you took what you've written there and top and tail it in such and such a way, you'd get a standalone paper out of that. And that wouldn't take you too long. So it wouldn't be, you know, too burdensome for you in terms of your other responsibilities, but would be useful for you to have in the knowledge that by the time you've had your viva and done any minor corrections, you may have a paper that's on its way. And if you can write, you know, in press next to a paper in an application form, that really helps you out if you do decide you want an academic career.
Right. So, and what you mentioned mostly relates to what a supervisor can do in an informal and, you know, personal capacity. I wonder if there is scope for more institutional support, and I wonder whether that systematic support is useful in the context of peer review. What I'm saying is, for academic writing, for example, universities organize, you know, writing retreat, academic writing workshops as part of the research and development initiative, right?
Yeah, that is the thing. Yeah. That's right. I mean, it's, you know, lots of universities do, and, you know, some, I mean, some universities do these a lot. Some of them don't do them very much at all. I think they're, some academics have effectively generated entire portfolios of work around that provision. In the same way that, you know, 30 years ago, you didn't have a book called How to Study at University or Your Study Skills Guide or something like that. You now have a whole shelf full of titles written by Stella Cotterill at any university bookshop. In the same way, this whole, you know, there's this very interesting industry of, you know, how to write your master's thesis, how to write your doctorate, how to get published for the first time. Many, many years ago, when I was having a tutorial with my second supervisor, who was Malcolm Tight, also at Lancaster. So he was the second supervisor, so I'd just see him every now and then. And we were talking about publishing and about books. And I said to him, do you make any money from this stuff? You know, a naive question from an early PhD student. And he said, no, not at all. The only way to make money out of it is to write how-to books. And he has indeed written several of those, actually. So fair play to him. So maybe that's where we're all going wrong. So I think that writing retreat, you know, if people like writing retreats, they should do them. Certainly people I see and who I know who work at other institutions or who I see on Twitter value the time they have on their writing retreats. And there are all kinds of other strategies as well. Like, you know, I've only got an hour a day, but I'm going to write within that hour and then put it together later and this kind of thing. I think, you know, writing's quite a sort of subjective thing, but I would hope that by the time you've finished a PhD in the social sciences, you should be able to write. And if you can't, well, then you've not received good enough constructive feedback from your supervisors. Because I think we shouldn't, you know, as supervisors, sometimes you've got to say, yes, your methodology doesn't stack up here, or what's going on with your discussion of your purposive sample. And at other times, we should be saying, right, well, you need to edit this down. You know, this needs to be sharper. This needs to be more concise. This needs to be expanded. And I always wonder whether that diminishes over time because we don't read as much as perhaps we used to or ought to. You know, if you read less, does that then impact on your writing? Does our writing become more functional as a consequence of the pressure to publish? And so we spend less time reading unless we know we're going to put it in something we're writing. You know, when was the last time we all sat around and read a whole bunch of journal papers, safe in the knowledge that we weren't going to use any of them in our own writing, but just because we thought they might be interesting to think about and maybe chew over with our colleagues or maybe embed in our teaching or something like that? Seems to me that that's harder to do these days as we get busier and busier. So I think, so in that sense, my advice is, write, but also read more as well. And then, you know,
right.
See how other people do it, you know, see how other people do it.
Yeah. Okay. So to conclude our interview, my last question is about maybe whether you have some general advice for PhD students, early career researchers who are thinking about submitting their first ever manuscript to a journal.
Yes, I have one which is really obvious, which is read the aims and scope of the journal.
Right.
And I mean, that said, I've been the victim in the past of sending something that I thought fitted the aims and scope of a journal that turned out didn't, but that's a story for another time. But yes, there, I do come across stuff where, you know, you read it and you think, well, this is clearly, you know, there's two things, aren't there? One is the quality argument we'll come to in a moment. The first thing is this: if it doesn't meet the aims and scope of the journal, it's going to get triaged straight away and you're going to get bounced back. And then you're taking up time. You're possibly going to, take a knock in self-confidence, which helps no one. But also you need to be thinking about who you want to read the stuff, right? You know, we'd all like more people to read our work than is perhaps sometimes the case, but we write in order to be read and to take part in a conversation. So I think if you think carefully about the kind of stuff you're writing and the kinds of things you're talking about, and use that to shape your decisions about which journal you submit to, as much as we all want things to be in high impact factor journals and so on and so forth, well, that's all great. But sometimes those journals, you know, just because it's in a high impact factor journal doesn't mean the paper's any good and doesn't mean anyone's going to read it. Because a lot of the time, impact factors might only be based on one or two papers that get enormous amounts of traction and all the rest just remain fairly unread. So I think, again, there is a useful moment where you can have a good conversation with a supervisor or another more senior member of academic staff just to say, well, this area of work, you know, where do people who are interested in this go for their journal articles? What are they reading? And that's the conversation you want to be part of. That's where you should be putting your stuff, rather than worrying too much about being in a journal that you perceive as being a flagship journal or prestigious or whatever it happens to be. So that's the first one. That goes alongside the more instrumental thing about aim and scope. And then the other thing is, I guess, you know, if you're not sure about the quality of the work, find someone who can read it for you and can say to you, well, I think you've missed this, or I think you need to say more about that. You know, lots of us do peer reviewing and lots of us do editing or on editorial boards. And so it's hopefully not a difficult thing for people to say, you know, have you got time, please, to have a skim over this and see what you think? Would it fit in your journal? Would it fit the kind of stuff that you think people are interested in? And take it away from a purely, you know, evaluative ref-based exercise and get back to a more interesting conversation about the kinds of academic discussions we want to encourage.
Thank you. I think that's a very important reminder. I think too often we think about impact factors too much in the prestige of journals. I mean, what you reminded us is really to do something that excites you, that is passionate to you. And I think that's equally important. I wouldn't say which one's more important, but equally important, I think, as an academic experience. If we want to have an academic career for decades, right?
it's got to be right, hasn't it? I mean, you can... You know, there were different ways that you can go about it. So, I mean, you know, purely in terms of ref, you know, so at Durham, we, you know, for the ref we've just had in the one before, we've had a couple of our professors on the ref panel for education. So for the 2014 ref, who's now retired now, Professor Richard Smith was on the education panel. And we had our debrief meeting afterwards. And he said, you know, absolutely clearly, the ref panel does not take into account the place of publication, right? It makes no difference to your ref score whether the journal has a high impact factor or is just on the, you know, emerging index. It makes no difference. We read the paper irrespective of where it comes from. So you've got that, you know, coming straight from a ref panel member, which should be, you know, good news for us to hear. But then there's other ways of publishing, of course, aren't there? You know, if peer reviewing through a journal is taking too long and you want people to get to your work more quickly, write a book chapter. You know, lots of people have always got calls for chapters edited book compilations, and they tend to come out more quickly. They also tend to be less brutal in their review because they want to get the book out, obviously, but they're not going to publish anything. But they tend to be more you know, permissive in terms of what they'll allow compared to journals. So it can be a way to get work that you think, if you think your work might be too hard for reviewers to cope with because you're trying something a bit different or that you've not tried before or you're not sure about, maybe writing a book chapter to get it out there in the first place is a nice way to go, because you'll certainly, in my experience as a book editor and also as writing chapters for edited books, you do tend to get a more helpful series of comments. And of course, you know that your chapter is often going to be nestled in with other stuff that's going to be of interest to a similar audience. And increasingly, book chapters are available, you know, they get given a DOI and are available individually online. So it's not the case that you have to wait for someone to, you know, buy a physical copy of the book in question before they're going to read your work.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Very, very interesting experiences, very useful suggestions. Thank you for accepting my invitation to share your experiences with us.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Right. So for our audiences, thank you very much for tuning in. So stay in touch for more episodes on Scholarly Peers podcast. We'll be interviewing other senior academics in education and beyond. And if you're interested in looking for more resources on journal peer review, please do visit our website, scholarlypeers.com. We regularly update and collate resources, blog entries, journal articles, and we also have a Twitter account, scholarly_peers on Twitter, if you want to know more about the news and also other people's experiences, do check it out. Thank you very much.